upstairs going on? Greg heard the brittleness in his own voice as he selected something that looked somewhat like finger sandwiches. Anson shrugged.
Might as well.
All the surface equipment is shut down. Even the scientific instrumentation outside takes a beating from the flare, so a lot of the researchers got nothing much to do.
What about communications? Greg asked.
The comm center is always manned, she said easily,
pulling out a soy burger on a bun and heading for the microwave ovens.
Even during a party.
Doesn't the flare interfere with communications?
We can always go to the laser comm system if the microwave gets too hashed up.
I didn't mean communications with Earth, Greg said.
I meant with the expedition.
Her face went serious. We've got 6 minisats in polar orbit. They're hardened, of course, but if the radiation levels exceed their hardening,
then those people are cut off.
Right, she conceded.
Then what happens?
We've got 2 more minisats as backups. We send them up after the radiation dies down. Not much more that we can do.
Greg thought hard for a few moments, then had to admit, I guess you're right.
The microwave pinged, and Anson pulled out her steaming soy burger.
Come on, let me introduce you to some of the gang. Are you straight or gay?
Greg nearly dropped his plastic dish.
What?
Gay or straight? Who'd you like to dance with?
Sex, Greg realized. It all comes down to sex. That's what this party is all about. The solar flare is an excuse for these people to have a gene pool enrichment, just like Neolithic hunting tribes that came together once a year to exchange virgins.
Anson was looking at him with a positively impish expression.
Have I embarrassed you? She asked.
No.
We get pretty close to one another, living cooped up in here for months on end, she said. I forgot that most people Earthside aren't as open as we are. I'm sorry.
It's okay, Greg said, trying to adjust his outlook. And I'm straight.
Great,
Anson said, with seemingly genuine enthusiasm.
Then you can dance with me.
Riding down the mountain was like dropping down a long, dark shaft. Brennard fired the hopper's main rocket engine once to lift them off the summit, then used the maneuvering jets to nudge them away from its slope. After that, it was a long, slow fall into the darkness below. Doug felt his stomach fluttering and wondered how Bianca was handling it. Brennard stood at the podium, his gloved hands on the controls like a sea captain of old at the helm of his storm-tossed ship. Instead of a sou'wester, he was encased in a bulky spacesuit, and instead of the heaving and rolling of the waves, their hopper was falling smoothly in the shadows of the massive mountains, plummeting swiftly, silently, like a pebble dropped down a deep, deep well.
This is what the old-time explorers must have felt like, Doug told himself. Danger and excitement and the thrill of doing things nobody's done before.
He grinned inside his helmet.
This is definitely habit-forming.
His earphones chirped with the signal from one of the minisats. Quickly, Doug plugged his vidcam into the comm port on the belt of his suit and played the tape at top speed. He heard a brief screeching in his earphones, like a magpie on amphetamines, then a verifying beep from the satellite. The data-compressed signal had been received.
What about transmitting our claim? Brennard asked before Doug could report to him.
Just did it, he said. Squirted the tape to the minisat. When it comes over Moonbase's horizon, it'll transmit the whole scene to the base.
How soon will that be?
Doug made a quick mental calculation.
The satellite's orbit is 1 hour. Should be in 40-50 minutes.
Brennard huffed again.
Plasma cloud might hit by then.
The commsats are hardened, aren't they?
Up to a point.
Is there a chance the radiation could knock them out before our message reaches Moonbase?
Ever heard of Murphy's Law? Brennard replied.
Yes, but
it's all a matter of degree. There's no such thing as absolute hardening. The minisats are built to withstand a certain level of radiation. If the plasma cloud's levels are higher, then the satellites will be kaput.
Then we'd be cut off from Moonbase.
Bianca's voice was filled with apprehension.
Until they pop up more satellites after the storm is over.
I wonder how hardened the Yamagata snooper satellite is, Doug mused. Brennard made no answer, and when Doug tried to talk to him, he realized that the expedition leader was talking to the ground on a different frequency. Doug switched to that channel.
Landing lights haven't been set up yet, he heard Killifer's voice, almost whining. You told me to get everybody inside. Never mind, Brennard snapped. Turn up the radar beacon to full power. I'd like to have some idea of where the ground is.
Right. Doug knew there were no lights beneath the hopper's platform. We could crash in this darkness, he realized. The little cluster of instruments on the control podium included a laser altimeter, and Doug saw that its digital readout was falling so fast the numbers were almost a blur. Still, Brennard did not fire the rocket to slow their descent. It's like parachute jumping, he thought. See how long you can stay in free fall before you chicken out and pull the ripcord. He felt his heart racing as he clutched the flimsy railing with both hands and marveled at Brennard's cool while the hopper plunged deeper and deeper into the eternal darkness.
Are we there yet?
Bianca's voice bleated in his earphones. She's trying to make light of it, Doug thought, but this long free fall must be bothering her. I wonder how she did on a trip to Moonbase from Earth. She must have been in misery all the way. Greenberg had said nothing since they'd climbed aboard the hopper and damned little before that. Doug realized that the nanotech engineer was as close-mouthed as anyone he had ever met. Straining his eyes, Doug peered over the railing into the darkness below. He could make out vague shapes in the darkness, like monsters from a child's nightmare reaching up to snare him. Then a lurch of thrust nearly buckled his knees, and the landscape below was briefly lit by the rocket's silent flame, like a scene suddenly illuminated by a lightning bolt's flash. Before Doug could blink, it was inky dark again, and they continued to fall. Then another flash and surge of thrust. Then a gentle bump, and Doug felt the comfortable reassurance of weight once more. They were on the ground.
"Don't just stand there," Brennard commanded. "Get off and into the shelter."
For a moment, Doug was transfixed, immobilized, with admiration for Brennard's piloting. The man really is as good as all the stories about him.
"Move!" Brennard bellowed.
Almost laughing, Doug knocked down the hopper's railing and jumped softly to the ground.
"Which shelter?" Greenberg asked.
He had turned on his helmet lamp, Doug saw. So had Brennard. He did the same, then Bianca followed suit.
"Number 4," said Brennard, pointing with a long arm. "The others are already occupied."
They trooped to the airlock, Greenberg in the lead. He may not say much, Doug thought, but he sure makes it clear that he wants to get safely inside.
"Don't take off your suits," Brennard commanded. "Go right through the lock and into the shelter. Leave your suits on."
Doug waited for Bianca to go in, then turned toward Brennard.
"Go on, go on,"
the expedition commander shooed impatiently.
"We don't have all damned day."
Doug ducked through the airlock hatch, waited for it to cycle, then stepped into the shelter. Bianca and Greenberg were sitting awkwardly on the edges of two facing bunks, still encased in their bulky spacesuits, looking like a pair of hunchbacked giant pandas. There were no internal partitions in this smaller shelter. It was merely a dugout for sleeping and eating. The pumps chugged, and the inner airlock hatch opened to let Brennard step through. He had to bend over slightly to keep the top of his helmet from scraping the shelter's curving ceiling.
"Not enough rubble on top of us to provide full shielding," he explained. "So we stay in the suits until the radiation dies down."
"That could be days," Ree blurted.
"We'll need the extra shielding the suits provide," Brennard said calmly. "It'll be uncomfortable, but better than getting fried."
"And the backpacks?" she asked.
"We can take off the backpacks and breathe the air in here, but otherwise we will stay buttoned up. Like the man says, better safe than sorry."
"What about eating?" asked Doug. Brennard turned toward him slowly, his helmet visor staring at him like a blank-eyed cyclops.
"We'll take a quick meal now before the radiation builds up. After that, I'll decide when and if it's safe to open our visors for food."
After a heartbeat span of silence, Brennard added in a more relaxed tone,
"A little dieting won't hurt any of us."
So they grabbed prepackaged meals from the shelter's food locker and took turns sticking them in the tiny microwave oven.
"Stand back from the oven. You don't want to get exposed to any radiation that leaks through," Greenberg said so solemnly that Doug couldn't tell if he was joking or serious.
Brennard raised his visor to eat his meal, and Doug could at last see the man's face. If Brennard was worried, he didn't show it. He looked calm, thoughtful, but certainly not jittery.
"That's our guide," he said.